Hello, and welcome to the American Writers Museum Author Talks podcast, where we bring the power of the written word straight to your ears. This week, Alan Light discusses spirituality and song, as well as his new book, Don't Stop, Why We Still Love Fleetwood Mac's Rumors. He is interviewed by radio host Ryan Arnold. This conversation originally took place November 24th, 2025, and was recorded live at the American Writers Museum. This episode is presented in conjunction with the American Writers Museum's new special exhibit, American Prophets, Writers, Religion, and Culture. This exhibit and our programming series explores the profound ways writing reflects and influences our understanding of religion. American Prophets is now open. We hope you enjoy entering the mind of a writer.
Hi, everybody. How are we doing tonight? All right, that's what I wanted to hear. For those of you who don't know me, I'm Kerry Cranston. I'm the president here at the American Writers Museum. I want to thank you all for being here and supporting the past, present, and future of American writing. And to introduce our guests this evening, instead of me, I'd like to bring up our board member, Ivan Kane, a member and past chair of our program committee, and a driving force behind our past exhibit, for those of you who saw it, on Bob Dylan Electric. And because of that, he worked closely with our author tonight. So please welcome Ivan Kane.
Thank you, Kerry. They gave me something to read, which I'm largely going to do with just a few additions. Tonight, we're exploring spirituality in American songwriting in conjunction with our newest exhibit, American Prophets, Writers, Religion, and Culture. In his work on contemporary and historical songwriters, Alan Light explores the deeper meaning of the music and its significance to our lives. Alan is the author of numerous books, including Holy or the Broken, the Leonard Cohen, Jeff Buckley, and the Unlikely Ascent of Hallelujah, which was adapted into an acclaimed documentary, as well as Let's Go Crazy, Prince and the Meaning of Purple Rain, and biographies of Johnny Cash, Nina Simone, and the Beastie Boys. He was a co-writer of best-selling memoirs by Greg Allman and Peter Frampton. By the way, I've done the Peter Frampton as an audiobook, which is read by Peter. Alan will tell you how much Peter wrote and how much he wrote. Alan was a senior writer at Rolling Stone and the editor-in-chief of Vibe and Spin. He contributes frequently to the New York Times, Esquire, and the Wall Street Journal, among other publications, and co-hosts the podcast Sound Up with Mark Goodman and Alan. I found out the biography you'll find in the back of his book, but it leaves out two important things. One is his latest book, which was on sale, Don't Stop, about Fleetwood Mac's Rumors, so he'll autograph it for you afterwards. And then I just want to say something a bit more about Alan's role here at the American Writers Museum. Alan curated our exhibit, Bob Dylan Electric, and it was one of our most successful exhibits to date. He'll be interviewed by broadcaster. You might know him. He did 11 years of afternoons at WXRT. Communicator and journalist Ryan Arnold. Welcome to you both.
The long walk from backstage.
The coolest backstage I've ever been at. Thanks for being here, everyone. I don't even know where to begin, really, because having two music people sitting down just talking about music, this could go anywhere and could go a really, really long.
That's why we show up.
Well, congratulations on the book. Don't Stop. Why do we still love Fleetwood Mac's Rumors? I think one of the coolest things that I learned reading the book and getting ready is how the book on Hallelujah, an unintended, not even a consequence, but a happy accident, Bob Ross would say, is when you were asking people what the song meant to them, you were blown away by some of the responses, and that directly led to, all right, I'm going to center this next book around that.
Yeah, first of all, thank you all for coming, and I'm so happy to be back here. As Ivan and Kerry mentioned, I had the privilege of working on the Bob Dylan exhibit a few years ago. Hopefully some of you got to see that, and I'm really happy to come back in another capacity. And another project and get to be part of it all again. And yeah, I don't know. Well, when I was working on the Hallelujah book, which was a really important book for me. I didn't really go in with the intention. I wanted to tell the story of this song and its crazy journey from Leonard Cohen writing it, turning it in, Columbia Records rejecting the album, not putting it out, to decades later it becoming the most beloved anthem in the world. And how did that happen? And there were all of these stories and all of these different turning corners and finding different covers and uses and all of these things. And I wanted to do that. But what I found as I was reporting that book, researching that book, was I would mention it to people just in my life, and everybody had a story about the song. Everybody had, we played it at my uncle's funeral. It was the first dance at my friend's wedding. My sister played it when her baby was born. And I wish I could say I was such a great reporter. I went out and found these great stories. But honestly, I would just mention it and people would tell me things. And it was so powerful to hear it, because when you do this every day, it is so easy to get jaded, to get cynical and feel like, music is not important like it used to be. It isn't the center of people's lives the way that the great music was. And, you know, but you, when you would hear people talk about this song and talk about their relationship to this song, they didn't talk about what movie was playing at that day or what was on TV. They talked about a song that they sought out to mark this landmark, unforgettable moment in their lives across a huge range, at the most celebratory times and the most tragic times.
So what were some of those times, those moments that people shared with you that just floored you?
Well, again, that you're talking about something that is, that you would alternately hear was played at funerals and at weddings. Like just that as a thing, right? And integrated into religious services across different faiths, sometimes very much rewritten, sometimes not. And this notion that this song exuded this power that people turned to over and over again in different contexts was something that really, it turned out to be my favorite part of working on that book, which was not something I had set as a goal going into that book. So, you know, I think we're going to sort of talk around spirituality a little bit, but that was about a spiritual relationship to something coming off of this song that was undeniable and that came up over and over again. So when I was thinking about what became a next book, and I noticed that a few years back when my son was still in high school, that all of his friends seemed to know Rumors and have some relationship to Rumors that they did not have to its contemporaries, to the great albums of the 70s that we may often think about as more important or respected than Rumors. Those were all old, it was not relevant to them, but they were all aware of this Fleetwood Mac album as an album. Maybe they didn't sit down and listen to all of it, maybe they did. Then starting to think about all of the different uses of songs from this album over the years in the culture, the All Rumors episode of Glee, Don't Stop as the Bill Clinton campaign theme, the recent TikTok phenomenon that have developed around a couple of the guy on the skateboard with the cranberry juice was one of the things that really established TikTok as a popular platform, particularly in this country. Okay, so it's a thing that keeps regenerating itself over the years. And then looking at the data and seeing, Rumors was the most streamed album of the 20th century on Spotify last year. More than any Beatles album, more than Nirvana, more than Guns N' Roses or whatever you might think. Rumors was the best-selling rock album of 2024, old or new, almost 50 years after its release. So this was sort of an observational hunch that turned out to actually be true. And what I realized was what I wanted to talk about was not the making of this album, which is of course the greatest rock and roll soap opera chaos of all time, right, but a story that we know and is out there in different ways. What I wanted to look at was how does this album live in the world today, now, and really center talking to young people who have continued to keep this album so popular, and what is their experience? Like, we can put all that down, but really talk to 30 some post millennials about their relationship to rumors and how they found it and when they turned to it and why
Before
it's important
you go into
to
the people that you found. Yeah. You talk about data, and it's the most streamed, it's the best selling, it's all these things. We have data to prove that. Five people sitting around in 1979, let's call it New Year's Eve.
Right.
Picture this.
Decades
if you will.
Over.
Decades over, you're looking back at these records that came out in the 1970s. What makes the list? And then which ones do we think are going to be around and relevant and popular and amazing in 50 years?
Yeah. I mean, you can challenge the picks, but right, if you're going to say five and you said Born to Run, Dark Side of the Moon, Hotel California, Rumors, Led Zeppelin IV is maybe the five biggest. And if you sat the rock establishment down on the end of the decade and said, which of these kids going to care about? Not one person would have said Rumors. They would have said, it's great, but it's a pop record. You know, kids like that. But those others, those are important statement, social commentary. That's stuff that really lives forever and lasts. And it turns out that stuff is very connected to its time and place and does not feel relevant to the lives of an 18-year-old right now. Whereas this album that is much more, I mean, is constructed much more as a pop album and deals in these themes of, you know, the beginning, middle, end, and afterlife of relationships is the most universal and eternal thing you can turn to. There was one girl I spoke to who said, yeah, we still listen to Rumors and we still read Jane Eyre. Some of these are, you know, smart ass kids, but you also get like, yeah, there's never a time that Jane Eyre is not going to, she's like, all right, we're not getting married off when we're 16 or, you know, whatever the details are, but exploring from a female perspective, these issues of navigating complicated relationships, there's never going to be a time when that isn't going to connect with young people as they are going through these things for the first time and discovering these, you know, where they fit in the world and where they fit in these relationships and how all this stuff works.
Well, we talk about timeless and what makes something timeless, and it's kind of jive. I mean, people think, oh, it's timeless and it gets thrown away. But when you look at this album that came out 50 years ago next year, like every track holds up. And in the second part of the book, which is absolutely fantastic, and I devoured it, you literally take us through track by track and reminds us albums are made to be listened to and experienced kind of all at once. And you literally have this roadmap going, see, here's what they're trying to say. And then how can you relate it? And the spiritual part of it, I think, is that everything is open to interpretation. But when these songs are laid out and you help guide the reader and listener through, you can kind of help them arrive at that.
Yeah. I mean, look, I'm not excessively sentimental about albums are a sacred format. I mean, we grew up, that is how we listen, but albums are a distribution system. And for all those years, that was the only way you could put out music. And I don't think it's a bad thing that now when you have 10 or 12 songs, then you can put out music. Now, if you have four great songs, you can put out four great songs. You can put out one song at a time. You can still put out an album and a longer form thing if that best serves the music you're trying to release. That should all be good for creativity, having those options. But there is also a certain experience that comes with the immersion of an album project and an extended project. I think there are a few things that are really fascinating about Rumors in relation to other albums. When you think about that, this is a band with three lead singers and songwriters. The only other band I can think of that you could talk about three singers and songwriters is the Beatles. And that's not three equals in the way that it is with Rumors. So Rumors is constantly shifting voice, perspective, point of view, where you are along that journey of your relationship. We know all the relationships are exploding. Lindsey Buckingham and Stevie Nicks are breaking up. John and Christine McVie are getting divorced. Mick Fleetwood is divorcing his wife back in London. All of this is happening at the same time, all of it while they're making this record. It's the craziest story ever. Like, you cannot begin to imagine, and all of it with cocaine being shipped by the busload into the studio every day. But they stick it out and commit to knowing that the music they're making is really special, knowing that there is a dynamic with this, like, they're like, what are we going to do? We're going to break up and then, like, go start other bands? That's stupid. Like, this was, we had the potential to do something great. Let's do something great at whatever the cost. So hearing these different constantly shifting voices, actually for kids who grew up not listening to albums necessarily, kind of feels more like a playlist. It's not one guy singing at you for 45 minutes. It's not Blood on the Tracks, you know, that requires maybe a different listening discipline. And two of those three are women. It is the biggest selling album in American history with majority female voices on it. That's not nothing. And at a time where A, the biggest pop stars in the world, of course, are Taylor Swift, Billie Eilish, Sabrina Carpenter, you know, it's women are controlling the pop space. And then B, I think the construct of four long hair white guys with guitars is kind of your parents' band. It's a lot, there's a lot easier way to hook into this when you're seeing Stevie Nicks and Christine McVie, both equal partners, not pitted against each other, but collaborative. This was a thing that listeners talked about over and over again, was the centering of the women's voices and the relationship between the women in that band is not like any other. There's nothing else you can point to that does that. So I think that there are a lot of ways into what Rumors is doing that make more sense to 21st century listeners.
Well, we talk again, going back to it being timeless. There's three generations now.
Yeah, three. That when people started saying, "Oh yeah, I heard it when my grandparents played it," that messed me up. I was not ready.
My question.
I was not ready for that.
Well, but to think about, you know, you when Rumors came out, you were an active music listener.
I was young, but I bought it when it came out.
And I was not yet born. However,
thanks for that, Ryan.
You're welcome. No, however, listening to the record, I have such a different connection to it. Like you said, it's not your parents' band. Or with some of the other artists, not your parents, it's your parents' band, rather. But so I have a totally different experience with it. But it seems like it's an album where, regardless of when or how you got into it, you can kind of all come to some common ground.
And I think that was the biggest surprise in some ways for me, was if you grew up with this record in real time, I think you can't help but define it by the story and the chaos, the tension, the anger, Stevie versus Lindsay. Anytime there's a poll of the greatest breakup albums of all time, it pins the number one spot. Nothing's close. Then the Adele record and a Sinatra record, right? But if you were born 20 years after this record came out, you know how the story went on. The band didn't end. They had more hits. They kept going. They, you know, they had plenty more chaos in their history, but you know that the personal relationships went on, the creative relationships went on. And I had young people saying, you know, it's a little overstatement to say that Rumors was kind of relationship goals for them. That's maybe a little much, but saying that they took life lessons from, hey, you break up with somebody and it's not the end of your history with that person, and it's not the end of work that you may do, and it's not the end of the world. They come to it from a very different place and hear a very different emotional spectrum of beginning, middle, end, afterlife of relationship. And I think to sort of get back to the sense of spirituality is a lot of that was about, they would say, you know, yeah, my parents played it, whatever, but it was about me finding this record for myself. It was about building whatever that relationship was that was immediate, that was what was speaking to them. And a lot of them were like, I listen to this record in the morning when I'm getting ready for school. I listen when I go for a run. I would never think of Rumors as a breakup album. It isn't that feeling to me at all. I can't imagine not thinking of it that way. But I think to go back to a point you were making earlier, because it didn't have the respect that surrounds, you know, Born to Run, Dark Side of the Moon as these big literary, you know, handed down from on high, there was space for kids to build their own relationship to it. I mean, one kid, he was like, Dark Side of the Moon, my parents sort of sat me down and were like, you need to listen to that. You know, if you grew up in a Springsteen household, there is a day when your dad is going to say, you got to listen to Born to Run. This is the greatest. Well, you're never going to build your own connection to, you know, any art, any project when it's bestowed upon you that way. And this one, even though they said they heard it, you know, growing up, it wasn't nostalgia. It wasn't, you know, because it didn't have that same kind of reputation. There was an avenue to say, what does this mean to me? What am I hearing in this? And is it more the beginning of relationships, happy songs? Is it more the angry songs? Does that shift, you know, as my life shifts? Whatever, I'll figure that out. And that's the power that this stuff can hold, particularly when you're swimming in it and exploring, again, to go back to Hallelujah, when you're exploring it yourself and finding that it can mean very different things, but all of those are very real.
I'm racking my brains. I can't think of another album. I can't. I mean, no jive. Can't think of another album that ticks those boxes. Something that was not bestowed upon you by, you know, the older, cooler generation, right? I mean,
look, I get hung up on this stuff because I edited magazines for a long time, so I think about it. But every time that Rolling Stone has done the greatest albums of all time list, Rumors jumps 20 spots up. Everything else drops down, as it sort of naturally would, because they get older, other things replace it, there's more energy or excitement. And look, Rumors, it's the seventh best-selling album of all time. It's not like it's some secret discovery. But the first time Rolling Stone did that list, it was like number 76. Okay, it's one of the 100 greatest albums of all time. The last time Rolling Stone did that list, it was number 7. I mean, whatever it is, 30, 40 years later, and that esteem, critical respect, whatever, only escalates. And that is a very, I don't know if that's entirely unique, but it is a very exceptional thing to have happen. The first time Rolling Stone did the greatest songs of all time list, Dreams was not on the list. The last time Rolling Stone did it, Dreams was number 9. Now it's one of the 10 greatest songs of all time. Before, not so much. So that, you know, to think about how something, why does the momentum continue to grow, continue to escalate, that was really what I wanted to explore and what I wanted to hear from, you know, these younger lists. I say kids, it's not, some of them were 16, some of them were 30, so not all kids, but people who were all born at least 15 years after it came out. What do they hear?
And then taking the individuals in the band, you know, Stevie Nicks, we were talking about how, was it a Rolling Stone list that came out in 1997, 98, about, you know, female
a book, a history of women in rock book, yeah.
And Stevie Nicks got a blurb.
Paragraph and a half.
Which was, and what?
And the words Christine McVie, this is 1997, first year of Lilith Fair, peak women in rock, alternative rock, whatever. Rolling Stone did it, I wasn't still there, but I was involved. Did a book about the history of women in rock. It was timely. Stevie got this much space in the book. The words Christine McVie did not appear in the book. If you did a history of women in rock book today, Stevie Nicks is on your cover without question. But how did that happen?
How did it
this
happen?
This cult around Stevie as an icon, whatever it is that she represents. I mean, that's a spiritual, that's the white witch. That's the, you know, the look, the scarves, the twirling, she is her own person speaking her own truth. She has come to represent, you know, really kind of that rock and roll independence. I can't think of a bigger female rock star in, you know, our world than what Stevie Nicks has become. But it was in its own steam in ways that was telling you earlier. I remember about 10 years ago, 12 years ago, I don't know, going to see Stevie Nicks in New York, and she played the Beacon Theater. Beautiful theater, 4,000 people, great show, great. And thought, okay, Stevie Nicks is someone who will continue to tour and sell out theaters, and she'll be fine. And 5 years later, she was selling out Madison Square Garden. And 5 years later, she is co-headlining stadiums with Billy Joel. It's not like there was a big Stevie Nicks hit in those 10 years that changed that. And some of that is Taylor Swift talking her up, Harry Styles inducting her into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame and having a close relationship with her. I mean, she exists in the pop world in certain ways, but also this mystical, you know, whatever it is, sort of otherworldly thing that surrounds Stevie that has absolutely transfixed this younger generation.
You start the book with...
Yes.
with Stevie Nicks talking about being awarded, if you will, a Barbie, when they made a Barbie, Mattel made a Barbie.
Revealing her Stevie Nicks Barbie doll at the Madison Square Garden show is where we begin this story.
Yeah, and I shared that with a friend of mine, and they're like, that's funny. That I know that actually happened. I mean, think about it now. We're really kind of talking about a fourth generation, sorry to freak you out, but we're talking about yet another generation where this band, or members of it, are going to play an integral part in people's lives.
I'm really interested in the, you know, every week Billboard still does their top 10 or top 20 vinyl sales. And we know that there's been this sort of steady resurgence of vinyl in recent years as a thing that young people are into. But being realistic about it, the stats also show that 50% of vinyl sales are made to people who don't own record players. They buy them at Urban Outfitters. They hang them on their wall. They put them on their shelf. It is a talisman. It is a fan offering that you make. And every week, the top 10 vinyl chart are 5 Taylor Swift albums, Sabrina Carpenter, Billie Eilish, Rumors, Lana Del Rey, Harry Styles. It is 9 pop, young pop star albums and Rumors every single week, unchanged. There's clearly something they just want to have it. They want to have it near them. There is a power, the cover image, the story of the band, the whatever it is. And I had kids say to me, I had some who were like, it sits on my turntable and every morning I put it on, whatever. And then I had others say, I don't own a turntable yet, but I want to know that when I buy one, the first thing I play on it will be Rumors. Like, what sort of mystic power is that, that it needs to be this thing that's, you know, physically exists in my world like that?
As a kid whose father showed him how to cue up a record before, you know, taught him how to play catch, that's just offensive and unfathomable that these are pieces of art to look at, when it's like, man, what is inside of it is so...
But it's all part of it, but it's all an experience. You know, all of these things are also, they're about the songs. They have to be first about the song. If people don't want the songs, the rest doesn't add up to anything, right? But with that, there was a guy I spoke to named Michael Ozawaru, who's a producer, works with Beyonce and Frank Ocean and sort of the great current R&B stars, and a huge Rumors fan. And he was saying, you know, in the world now, particularly where we're bombarded by everything all the time, that for something to really stick, it kind of needs multiple entry points. That it needs to, I heard this, but then I saw this other thing and I read, and sort of there's a cumulative, okay, then now what is that? That's a thing I want to find out about. And that Rumors, between the aesthetic and the album cover and the soap opera and the backstory and all of these different uses in the culture and this embrace from TikTok and the Tony Award winning play Stereophonic last year, that is a barely fictionalized version of the Rumors story, emphasis on barely, not on fictionalized. All of this, you know, sort of adds up to this experience, these associations with this project that, you know, cuts through all of that stuff and leaves this impact. And you can't, none of these things, you can't separate them out from there's always been, the look is important to pop music. It's Beatles haircuts and it's Elvis's, you know, sneer and it's Run DMC sneakers. And that's always part of the game. But the fact that it has all of these things, the relationship to the story, to the soap opera, was also really interesting to hear, because there were some kids who were like, we're theater kids, we love drama, we're obsessed with the lore, we follow the story, we know all who's singing about what and all of this stuff. And there are others who were like, I don't know anything about that. There was one girl I asked, when did you find out about all of the craziness around the album? Was it before you heard the music? And she said, when you just asked me that question, I don't know what you're talking. I don't know what that is. My relationship to the songs has nothing to do with that.
Well, speaking to the experiences, and I was talking with a guy who it was about concerts, live music. And he said, go to a show, any show, and you're going to stand next to someone, and the 2 or 3 hours at that show could be the best 2 or 3 hours of that guy's week. And how cool is it that we get to experience that without even knowing it? And I started to think like,
well, and contribute to it.
Exactly. And music is the great equalizer. It's like the leveler. It doesn't matter any label that is attached to it. It has no bearing, because the music is going to be there for you to do for you whatever you needed to do at that time.
Thinking about coming and doing this event, I was thinking I would never define myself or think of the work that I've done as consistently addressing music and spirituality. But then when you look through these people that I have written about, writing about Hallelujah, writing about Prince, writing about Johnny Cash, writing about Nina Simone, these are figures where spirituality is fundamental to what their music was, what they were, what their obsessions were, what they were trying to work through in their art, you know, so directly and tangibly and immediately. And I've never thought about that as a through line, you know, but the art, but in a lot of ways, I think artists that are worth thinking about it, that sort of, with that sort of depth and that sort of focus, almost inevitably, one way or another, it's about some complicated and some very nuanced relationship to whatever spirit. I mean, when you're talking about Johnny Cash, you're talking about a more, not fundamentalist, but a more sort of literal Christian thing. But then he would sing a song like Man in Black and sing about singing for the oppressed and singing for the prisoners and all of the work that he did, you know, in his actual life. When you talk about Prince, you know, I think in some ways the most radical part of Prince's project was, when we think about soul singers, R&B singers, we think about the division between the spiritual and the sacred. And it's the thing that destroyed the tension. That's what destroyed Marvin Gaye and Al Green and Sam Cooke, and not being able to, you know, find a way to balance or integrate these things. Prince was, these are the same thing. Prince's songs were sex and God, that we're talking about the same stuff. And that was a, you know, wildly revolutionary thing to present in his work. So in the end, yeah, I mean, it's doesn't mean anything to say that all of art is wrestling with this stuff, but all of those kinds of musicians clearly are wrestling with the internal and external expressions of those questions.
Well, talking about the work that you do and are continuing to do, before we go and turn it over to Q&A, how has what you learned through all of this, that through line that you just described, how is that going to change whatever is next for you?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think that what's both great and sort of annoying about doing these books is, when you're making a case, there is no song like Hallelujah. There is no album, at least at this moment, that functions and, again, lives in the world the way that Rumors does. Well, it's not like, okay, then I can go do the next one. I just spent the whole book saying there is no next one, so I'm not doing that. You know, obviously I am interested in these sort of close focus, you know, if somebody wanted me to do sort of a big biography of a great artist, like maybe, but even I, when you're reading those books for me, and you hit like, and in his sophomore year of high school is when he joined, I'm like, I'm bored, I don't care. You know, like, I'm glad somebody did the work and we have all of that documented and it's there when you need it. I don't really want to go through the high school yearbooks that much. I'm sort of more interested in finding a, whatever a moment means, and then really kind of looking at what all the layers and pieces of that are.
Finding,
and so I would, whatever it will be, I would imagine it starts from a place like that. And again, now that I've sort of found this, you know, I don't want to just spin my wheels, but this idea of what is, even just personally, what is powerful in hearing these stories and these you know, like I said, in some ways you just need the injection of, yeah, right, this stuff is like, I'm not wasting my time doing this. It's important to people.
Yeah.
And they'll tell you very specifically with very real thoughts why it's important to them. And I don't think that's been looked at enough. I don't think that the listener, as opposed to the creator's experience, that the listener's experience, and then what the impact, what the legacy, what all the ripples that come out of that can be, still feels like a thing that I want to find ways to explore.
Finding the moment and exploring them. Thanks for sharing this moment here. Thanks for sharing it with me. It's been great to reconnect with you over this. Alan White, everyone.
Thank you. So I very much want to hear what people want to talk about.
So you haven't talked a lot about it, but you did some work for the Beastie Boys.
I did.
I know they experimented a lot with different types of music before they got into rap in the 80s. Can you talk a little bit more about what you did with them? And of course, as they faded out, when some of their members pass away, that type of thing?
Sure. And, you know, and again, a spiritual journey going on there as well, right? As that story got more complicated. You know, I came of age in the mid 80s. And when the Beastie Boys, when License to Ill came out and exploded in the way and exploded and became the first hip hop album to go number one, I just had that feeling of that could be me and two of my idiot friends so easily if we just were stupid enough to, like, these guys listen to the same records we do, the same TV shows they're joking about. Like, I get what this is. But there were a lot of questions about a white group having the first number one hip hop record and where that was, where they were embraced by the hip hop community, but what it was to navigate that. And, you know, this was sort of the peak of like postmodernism in the 80s, and putting records together through samples and tape loops and all of that stuff was very, you know, that was, they were sort of leading the edge. So I was fascinated by all that. I ended up writing my thesis for an American Studies degree at Yale University about License to Ill. Was made fun of in national publications for getting away with that, but I will always love my American Studies department. And then from there was fortunate enough to be able to do a bunch of stuff, features in Rolling Stone, a cover for Vibe, a cover for Spin, sort of consistently working with them through the years, ultimately kind of rolling that up into what was my first book, The Skills to Pay the Bills. But even that, for these guys who came out as these absolute knuckleheads, that was their thing. Within a few years, Adam Yauch is beginning his exploration of Buddhism and taking this, you know, very serious spiritual journey and expanding not just musically what they were doing, but thematically what they were addressing. And it was a really fascinating to go through that in real time with them and talk to them sort of album by album about that evolution. I was very fortunate to sort of be within that circle. And, you know, they were just such a model of the best ways that a band can work, the best ways that the sort of mutual respect, allowing for independence, allowing each member to kind of have their thing they were responsible for, was really a great lesson to think about how you do, how you grow as a collaborative creative entity. So you know, I look back really fondly on having that time with them, and they were great, and losing Adam was terrible. But I think they continue to sort of be such a model for young bands to look at and learn from.
I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit more about the kids that love Fleetwood Mac and Rumours. Who are they? I think you said that you talk to 30 some teenagers.
Yep.
And I'm just wondering how diverse that group is and what that looks like.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Yeah, again, I would like to pretend that I'm a better reporter than I am. Honestly, one sort of super lame, vague social media post was like, hey, anybody have kids or younger relatives or friends who are into Rumours? Let me know. I think I booked 12 or 13 interviews the next day, which is very validating because you're also like, oh, okay, they're really out there. It isn't hard to find them. And then just sort of growing from there, there were two young women who sat behind us at the Stevie Nicks show at Madison Square Garden. And I had to find a way to not feel creepy asking them if they would talk to me. That was the hard, like, I'm here with my wife. I'll give you, you email me. I'm not going to email you. Like, that's too, and they were great. And then just sort of running into a friend was like, oh, my, one of my interns this summer was talking about Rumors and how much he loves Rumors. So there was age diversity. And again, that it was sort of 16 to 30 ended up being the range. And there was an interesting geographic diversity. Cause I had kids from, I mean, this is like, I'm from Cincinnati and I'm a big Reds fan. And there's a guy who's a broadcaster blogger who covers the Reds and mentioned in one of his columns, like, hey, my daughter was listening to Rumors the other day or something. And I wrote him and was like, hey, want to, see if your daughter wants to talk to me. And she was at University of Louisville or something. So you just sort of put your antenna up at that point and try to fill them in. But again, most striking is just what the numbers show you, that on, again, the Spotify streams are so far ahead of the other things in that time period and that category. I don't know, maybe people aren't as impressed by this as I am. Dreams has been streamed more times in the US than Bohemian Rhapsody or Don't Stop Believin'. I was shocked to see, like, I just feel like Bohemian Rhapsody we hear every single day somewhere and it's in everything and whatever it is. This is bigger than that.
I can tell you that 30 some years on the radio, I have never played Bohemian Rhapsody, okay. I swear to God.
Put the next classic rock jock in this chair and ask him what he's done.
Ow, classic rock jock. Well, thanks a lot.
That's the distinction I am drawing. There are three, Dreams has more than 2 billion streams. Go Your Own Way and The Chain, which wasn't a single, have more than a billion streams. I mean, these are towering numbers. And the others just, I mean, I love Springsteen. I love Born to Run. Some of the album cuts on Born to Run have not hit 100 million streams. They're sort of parked in the like 50 million, like, which is okay, but it ain't 2 billion streams.
To say 50 million streams, come back and talk to me later.
Well, on if you're putting it next to Born to Run, universally hailed as one of the greatest albums of all time, but kids are not, you just look at that and you're like, well, no kids are listening to this.
So you mentioned some of these folks, Prince, Johnny Cash, Beastie Boys, and Fleetwood Mac, and talking about how there's a spiritual element. So thinking about that with that context, like these are, I see these as genre changing, life changing, amazing forces in music. I'm really interested and curious about kind of how you define spirituality and how you're using that term or that framework with thinking about these artists.
Oh, you would ask for specificity around that, wouldn't you? I think if you asked every single person here, they would give you a very different answer. And if you went through the exhibit, you know, over there behind us, you would see every one of those writers addressing this in different ways. Some of them are obviously more explicit. I mean, Johnny Cash recorded gospel albums, Nina Simone recorded gospel songs and things that are very literal religious songs. Prince, that would be a complicated thing to answer how directly religious we think of. There are times, particularly after his Jehovah's Witness thing, there are things that are more specifically about that. But I think we all know there is sort of that distinction between the religious and the spiritual and this sense of wrestling with meaning and ideas and themes that are larger than ourselves and that get to our purpose on earth one way or another. And that can come through any number of things. Again, that's why I'm saying I feel like virtually anybody that you think about who is an artist of this magnitude, those questions can't not be part of the project. I don't know how to do better than that.
I think not being a mind,
I mean,
like
not
yours,
written that,
but I think, you know, a power greater than oneself, it's not a hard notion to wrap your head around. And anyone who's getting involved in something that is going to be put out, music that's going to be put out to so many different people, kind of understanding that this is going to be interpreted in any number of ways.
And people turn to this stuff for, as you said, for community, for a sense of, oh, this is somebody who can articulate these things that I am feeling and questioning. Again, I do think for this album, particularly for adolescents going through first time relationships, going through first time breakups, you know, looking at that thing, this is an album that can speak for different, you know, stops along the way as you're going through that. That's really important. And again, that it's not a single perspective of here's the divorce album and I'm just pissed off for 45 minutes. That's what you're going to get. This is something that is representing a lot of different facets of what that is. And I could clearly hear that resonating with these listeners.
Well, I grew up in adolescence at the American Embassy in Germany. Germans listened to techno. And I went to German school. And when I got back to the United States, I went to high school. And I never heard of Britney Spears, but she was on every guy's locker door.
Yes.
And in high school, because I didn't know about any American culture, I listened to WBIG, Washington's Big Oldie Station. I don't remember Fleetwood Mac.
Did all the homework, yeah.
But in high school, we listened to Kairos and we listened to the Grateful Dead, Ripple and Addicts of My Life. But I feel like I would like you to talk a little bit about the people that you met of another generation and about Spotify, because I feel like you go to Spotify and you already know what you're looking for when you go there. And so I have a record player. I play my parents' vinyl records. So I don't really know how streaming works. So can you also kind of explain more about the younger generation and how do they find things on streaming, like what you were describing in your book and what you've been talking about in this conversation?
Point number one, I feel like I would be remiss if I didn't say it's really interesting to hear you talk about growing up listening to techno and club music in Germany and then to the Dead here, because I think those are so similar and so much about seeking transcendence and spirituality. Those, both of those scenes, you know, people speak in religious terms about what they are seeking in going to those events and performances. I mean, that's like barely below the surface spiritual connection. It is the power of both of those communities and a very real and very tangible one. Look, I think that we all know that the streaming world, in whatever capacity, for music, for film, for TV, for whatever it is a, there's a mixed blessing to it. I will always say my son listens to a crazy range of music and was, Ryan knows him, he was, went to school in the other side of town, in Hyde Park, went to the University of Chicago and graduated last year, where for 3 years on the college radio station, he had a show playing exclusively 60s and 70s Brazilian, Bossa Nova, Tropicália. Now, that is something we never could have done if we didn't have access to everything. If the streaming libraries weren't there, I would maybe have heard of Caetano Veloso and like gone to the record store, bought one record, and if I liked it, had them order one more record that 2 months later, like, it's inconceivable that a previous generation could do 3 years every week playing. So that has to be good. Having access to that and having the ability to explore and deeply plumb, you know, music that never would have been accessible previously can only be a thing that is good, that opportunity. Of course, we know there's a lot of casual listening and grazing, but there always was. I mean, Top 40 Radio was. Like, that's not a new, that there are more lean-back listeners who just kind of want to hear what the big stuff is not something that streaming invented.
Well, and to your point about going to Spotify and already knowing what you want to listen to, that's true. I love discovering new music. So going to Spotify with the intent of, I'm going to find something that I have no idea what it is. If someone else says, I go to record stores a lot and buy a lot of records, and some of the best recommendations for new music and music discovery have come from people who are browsing the aisles. asking the guy who's working behind the counter, what's new? New, and remember, it's just, right, got to be new to me.
Right. And real quick, just to something somebody asked, maybe you asked just about album listening, a final fine point on rumors is, now, again, you have these options, and a lot of it is just, I'll listen to a song I like, and I'll listen to another song I like. The things that kids invest in as albums and really listen to as a full project, which is to say a Taylor Swift album, a Beyoncé album, a lot of that is because there is this narrative and story that goes with it, right? If you commit to, this is a thing I'm really going to stay with and study and listen, it's because, oh, she wrote this about him. This is, she's talking about this thing. I know what this one really means. This is about that friend that she broke up with. Rumors invented that. The idea that, you were listening to an album and that it was an extended narrative and he's singing this about her, but she's answering about this and this is what's really going on. You know, before that, there were actual like rumors. There was Paul is dead. There is You're So Vain, right? There's Louie is dirty. There's like things that if you were in the know, you knew, but they weren't a story that you were invested in. And I do think that's another thing, that commitment that kids do make to things as albums, sort of qua albums, is a model that rumors was sort of a blueprint for.
I wanted to ask you about the writing part. So,
oh, the writing part.
You are obviously
the mind of a writer over here on this. I was like, oh my God, I don't want to talk about that.
Oh, okay. You can skip this, but your passion is really obvious. And so I'm sure that helps make the writing, you know, flow. But is there anything you keep in mind when you're writing a narrative so that it isn't just like facts, just a list of facts? How do you keep us turning the page?
No, that's a great question. And I think a thing you learn when you do it a couple of times is that you can't sit down and say, I'm going to write a book now. You know, you just, like, that's an impossible thing. And so on a practical level, I think you start from like, okay, I have this much time and this is going in at least. Here's the stuff I want to do. That means I should kind of be here by this point. I should kind of be here by this point. And you start breaking it down into something that's more incrementally finite. At least this is what I have found is, okay, I'd like an outline. If I have that by this time, I'm fine. If I have, you know, and then I'm writing a couple of hours a day with sort of a sense of, if I'm writing 2,000 words a day, I'm on the right track. Some days I might write 6,000 words, but I'm still going to do the minimum the next day. I placed two big bets on this book structurally, both of which have come up. One was I knew that I wanted to center these listeners' voices as a backbone for a lot of what I wanted to do. Was that actually going to be interesting? Did people really want to hear from, they don't know who these kids are. And I wasn't going to know until I'd done it if it felt like that was going to be able to carry the weight that I wanted it to carry. They were great, and I feel really good about how that's integrated into this. And I had to figure out, you don't want to sort of overload at the front. Here's a bunch of people you don't know and what they think. Who cares? But build to, here is this phenomenon, and now let's talk about why that may be and let them explain that. And the other big bet was, as you said, the center of the book is song by song. I knew here's these 12 songs, and I knew here are these stories and themes that I want to address. Some of them are very easy. When I'm going to write about dreams, I'm writing about the guy on the skateboard with the cranberry juice. That's the story that goes there. When I'm writing about Oh Daddy, which is a song that like not everybody loves, but it's really Christine writing about Mick Fleetwood, who was A, the only father in the band, and B, the sort of father figure for the band. I knew I wanted to write about him and the rhythm section, and like, okay, that can go there. So like half of them were really easy. And then the next quarter were sort of like, okay, I can figure that out. But you can't say I'm going to do this and then I'll do it for 10 out of 12. That means now I got to come up with something for each one. And so a couple of them was, am I sort of jerry-rigging this too? Or do I have something that feels substantive enough to give that, you know, enough weight as I'm going through these stories? I think I pulled it off, but there's a moment of you're like, wow, I'm assuming that I can do this, is that something I'm really going to be able to do? So some of it was a little bit of jigsaw puzzle of where does this thing go? What's the opportunity to address this thing that I know I want to do?
Well, he's a great storyteller. He's a great storyteller.
Thank you, Ryan.
Alan Light, ladies and gentlemen. Don't stop why we still love Fleetwood Mac's Rumors.
Thank you for listening to this episode from the American Writers Museum Podcast Network. Be sure to subscribe so you are notified when new episodes are released. Now go, be inspired, and find the mind of a writer in yourself.